Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/decide. That's linkedin.com/decide. Terms and conditions apply.
Home run will put the White Sox ahead.
They're going to give us a run on a ground ball, except probably the third.
Yeah, the infield's playing back. Carlton Fisk facing Bob Stanley.
Hey, go!
Get out there!
Back! Please get
it!
Holy cow! Carlton Fisk has put the White Sox ahead. A line drive. I was afraid it might not get up high enough. And the White Sox lead. Look at Fisk. Look at Fisk. Holy
Here's
cow.
Your face in, Ari. He hit a low break.
Look at the White Sox dugout.
Woo!
Hey!
What a return to Boston for Pudge. You think, Coombe, about all the great moments in Carlton Fisk's career. That has to be right up there with all of them. And it takes a special player, I think, to be able to rise to the occasion when the spotlight is the brightest. And that is why Carlton Fisk is a Hall of Famer. Hi, everyone. A happy Memorial Day alongside Ron Coomer, Zach Zaidman with you, broadcasting live from the Hyundai Studios, brought to you by your local Hyundai dealers here on Chicago Sports Radio 670 The Score. And joining us now on the Alpamonte Ford Hotline, Alpamonte Ford in Melrose Park. Coombe, I will let you do the introduction.
Well, we got Carlton Fisk, one of my buddies and somebody who has made a big impact on my playing career. But, Pudge, when you hear that, now I'm guessing that doesn't play. Linda's not letting that play in the house over and over, that or the 75 home runs. So when you hear that from then, the first game you play back in Fenway Park, does it give you chills still, you know, all these years later?
Well, I don't know about chills, Coombs, but it, at the time, I'll tell you, it was the, maybe the most satisfying home run I have ever hit. I know that the 75 series is the most remembered, but to go back there after the way they treated me, to basically stick it to them, and I did a number of times back there too. So, but that was the first one, and it was a game winner, and it was pretty exciting.
Well, I remember when you came to Chicago, I was living, obviously, born and raised in the city, and what an impact that made just on the way the franchise was thought of. You know, the team had some players, and they were young, but they were moving the right direction. And then all of a sudden, the White Sox started bringing in some real serious professional players that, you know, were winners. And you coming in made a big impact. I remember for all of us just thinking, wow, the White Sox are for real now. But to open up the season the next year in Fenway, you had to look at that when the schedule came out and just grinning from ear to ear. I know you were.
I wondered how that was going to work out. You know, going back there, it could work one of two ways. It could be, a big negative reception, or it could be a big positive reception. And it basically – there was a smattering of applause when I was introduced. There were some boos also, but when later on the game when Stanley came in and I hit that home run off him, the whole stadium, the reception was unbelievable. The reason that I wasn't there anymore is because of Haywood Sullivan and Buddy LaRue, and it was almost as if they were cheering me, and in the process, that cheer was directed back towards them in their treatment of me. So I don't think it could have scripted it any better. Not that it always works out that way, because obviously it doesn't. But in that situation, boy, it was hard to wipe that smile off my face.
Yeah, and that was
how long
on
was the try around the bases?
You know what I was thinking after I did? I went, you know, I should have gone like, you know, took me 2 minutes to go around the bases.
Totally.
Maybe go around like Jimmy Pierce. I should go around backwards, you know, or something. Could have been weird. You know, the funny part about it, you know, there was Jimmy Pearsall and Harry up in the booth. And what was it, the next year that D was on the north side? So,
yeah.
You know, what a way to get introduced.
Do you think they were excited for you about that home run after listening?
They, you know, and Harry had seen a lot of baseball. And, of course, Jimmy had played a lot of baseball. And to have them get that excited, they knew exactly what the situation was and how.
Absolutely.
You know, and how special it turned out to be.
We're joined by Hall of Famer Carlton Fisk here on Chicago Sports Radio 670 The Score. So you were jubilant on the field after that home run. What was it like after the game? You get dressed. Did you guys go out? Did you actually have a celebration like you won a playoff game because of what transpired?
No. I think we all knew it was, at the moment, it was pretty exciting, but boy, there was a lot of baseball left to play for sure. And we were just all trying to get together and be a team and get to learn something about each other. But it all, you know, in a couple of years, it all came together in 83. I swear that was the best team and the most opportunistic team that I think I've ever played on. There was not a team that players came through in the clutch and pitchers pitched like they never had before or since. And I think this was just the first step into being more than respectable.
Pudge, when you look back at that team, because I remember that team distinctly, you had kind of the whole gamut. You had some guys that could run at the top. You had boppers in the middle of the lineup. You had defense. You had pitching. You had a few veterans smattered in with the young guys. But the chemistry part of that team with Tony La Russa as the manager, as a young manager, and you and some of the other guys, what do you think, when do you find out that, you know, is it spring training? Because we saw it in 16 with the Cubs and 15 with the Cubs a little bit. And I played for some teams, you know, like the Cubs team in 01. Right away, we knew we had something special. It didn't turn out quite the way we wanted, but we knew we had something special in spring. When did you guys know it in 83?
Well, you know, it we knew we had something special, but it never came about. You know, it just was, when is this going to take off? And, you know, up until June, I think that, we were just kind of scrambling around. And then all of a sudden we started winning a couple of games. And Doug Rader was coaching for Texas. And he says, boy, those guys are winning ugly. And we would. You know, we'd be messing around, make an error, and go behind. Then all of a sudden a bad hop or a slimper over here or, an error. And then we'd get back on top. But from June until the end of the season, there was not a team that ever played better than we did. The strange part about it was I was the number two hitter. And Rudy Law was leadoff. And, you know, so it was my job to protect him and to get him over. You know, and he stole 77 bases that year. And I think that I helped out a lot. And you know, I knew my offensive responsibilities. It wasn't to try to hit home runs, even though I did hit a few. But the number two hitter, you've got to be able to handle the bat and move the guys along, and hopefully you get on in the process.
Kind of amazing when you think about it that 83 team, it marked the first postseason appearance since the 1959 World Series. It was the first for the city of Chicago when it comes to baseball of any kind since the White Sox reached the World Series in 1959. I think fans have kind of been spoiled this millennium, but back then that was a monster deal.
You know, it really was. You know, I can't speak to a lot of what happened before, but I know going in there, I remember the Red Sox, that, you know, Chicago, you know, had a few pitchers, but they weren't really a team you ever worried about. Other than them playing in Chicago, and you wondered when the North Side and the South Side were going to put together a team. But, you know, on the south side, he had Bill Beck as the owner, and he was more of an entertainer than he was let's get a good team on the field. And then recently, with the White Sox and the Cubs winning the World Series, that, you know, we kind of showed back up again. And now both organizations are you know, pluses and positives. There's not a rollover team in Chicago now. You know, the worst part about it, Coombs, is that my grandsons are now Cubs fans.
No.
John and
what a
Greg.
Country.
You know, it's really weird. And I go over there and I wear my sock stuff, and boy, they almost kicked me back out of the house. I ask if they want to wear my sock stuff. They go, no way. My dad would kill me. You know, so now I got to contend with a couple of Cubs fans. And hi, Connor. Hi, Sean. And they think you and Pat and the Cubs are the best thing that ever walked the face of the earth.
Oh, God bless them.
Yeah, right, yeah.
Hey, and I'll tell you what, I'll get you tickets at Wrigley Field anytime you want to bring them grandsons to Wrigley Field, buddy.
Oh,
I promise
no,
you
there
that.
You go. You know, they're probably listening, and so they're going to write it down. Ron Coomer says I can come anytime I want.
I think we could come up with some great seats, and to see you in that nice Cubs hat sitting behind home plate with a dog enjoying a ball game, I could think of nothing better than to see that.
I can guarantee there'll be a hot dog involved, but I'm not quite sure about that. But we'll work on that.
There we go. No doubt about it. That would be great.
Yeah, we'll find out just how valuable those tickets are, Coom, right?
Hey, when you have, I'll tell you one thing, Zach, and you know this from all the years you being with the Bears, and now with the Cubs, when you put HOF at the backside of your name and you're in sports, hell, you can get the best tickets in town at any time you want. And it's a phone call away, trust me. I've ridden on the coattails of the Commander here many times to get a good ticket or a great tea time or a good reservation, trust me.
Yeah, well, no wonder I couldn't run very fast. I had to drag somebody.
You're damn right, and I'm a big load now, brother.
Bigger load than you used to be. Is that what you're saying?
That's right.
Oh, no. I tell you what, we're having so much fun here. Pudge, can you stick around for another segment? Because we've got a lot of questions for you. All right, perfect.
Yeah, I'll send you my bill. Don't worry.
He's not doing anything. I know that. He's sticking around.
This is great. Social isolation isn't very exciting, you know? You know, when you got nothing to do, you know what you do? Nothing.
Yeah, well, we appreciate you spending time doing nothing with us. Let's take a quick break here. When we come back, question number one, right out of the break, I'm going to ask the Hall of Famer, Carlton Fisk, how in the world did someone who has an HOF, right before you say his name, become so tight with a guy who doesn't in Ron Coomer? That answer is next. Ron Coomer's along. I'm Zach Sageman. Pudge rejoins us on Chicago Sports Radio 670 The Score.
And Fisk will lead it off, has a single and has walked twice. And the wind blowing out. There it goes, a long drive. If it stays fair, home run. We will have a seventh game in this 1975 World Series. A lot of body English for Carlton Fisk. Watch him.
How many steps does he take? One, he waits to see it. Get over.
He knew it. There it is.
One of the most memorable home runs in baseball history, Carlton Fisk winning Game 6 of the 1975 World Series in the 12th inning with that leadoff home run. By far and away, I would think, the greatest moment of your career. We talked about the home run with the White Sox when you returned to Boston, but there's nothing quite like winning a World Series game with a home run. Very few players in the history of the game have been able to do it, and you had that feeling. Carlton Fisk is with us. Ron Coomer's along. I'm Zach Sageman. Let's start with that and the snapshot memory in your head when you think of that home run.
Could it have been any more perfect? It couldn't have been. The only way it could have been more perfect than that is that if it was the seventh game or it was the winning game of the World Series. I keep telling Johnny Bench. I said, you know, we won that series 3-4.
That's exactly right.
But everybody only remembers that home run. You know, they don't hardly remember anything else that happened. But, you know, the greatest part about that was that I'm not sure whether it's the exact moment or not, but that was the time when television really kind of made a statement within the game. I mean, there was more TV cameras in the ballpark than ever before. And as a result, they caught that moment. And I get a chance to relive it every World Series, which is pretty exciting. I look at that and I go, who is that young guy?
Choking up, too.
I don't
choking
feel
up
so
on
young
the bat?
Anymore. Yeah, wow. You think about, oh, man, that was a long time ago. But what a special moment that was.
How many times did you tell Johnny Bench, thanks for putting down that finger instead of the other
every
one?
Every time. Oh, not very often, only every time I see him.
Carlton Fisk is with us here on Chicago Sports Radio 670, The Score. And Pudge, can you give our listeners an idea of how you and the Coombdog became so tight?
Well, that's amazing, you know, when you think about it, because I remember him as a player at Lockport, and it was a little before my kids went to school there, but I remember the name coming up, and he went on and signed, but then hurt his knee. Oh, by the way, Coombs, I still have that sweater you got me from the California San Jose shop.
Destaways, yeah. Ugliest damn thing ever. It's the only thing we had in the pro shop. It's best I could do.
Yeah, well, I still have it anyways. Anyway,
I appreciate that.
I use it to whack my car, but other than that, it's pretty good.
I knew there was a bump coming somewhere.
Yeah. Next time I see it, if I get tickets to the game, I'll wear it.
Beautiful.
Yeah. Anyways, and then Coom hurt his knee and got in contact with me. And, you know, we worked on his game, worked on his swing, worked on his head. And it was pretty refreshing because as you go along, the old guys don't get much respect from the young guys in that the young guys come along and think they know it all and are very seldom overly receptive to suggestions and instructions or even constructive criticism. But Ronnie was a sponge. He was so enthusiastic and so ready to work and so ready to get better. And, the credit to you, Ron, to come back from that knee and then have a big league career. It was amazing.
Well, we were all fortunate in our town, Zach, that, you know, when Pudge came over to the White Sox, he moved into our area in the Lockport school district, the Lockport area. And I had hurt my knee in college, but the second year I'd signed, even though I still needed some surgery on my knee to get my ACL repaired. But I remember seeing Linda at Lockport High School, your wife, and just asking her, because we had met once before at a friend's house while I was in high school. And all I said was, could I just get a half hour with Carlton to talk to him about hitting? And I remember I just had some real questions in my game that I could hit, and I had done really well in college, but the wooden bat had really changed my game to where I couldn't hit the ball for power. I wasn't pulling the ball right. And I knew I needed to make some changes. And, you know, you were in town and you were around the school some. And I just thought, if there's ever a person around that you could talk to, who better than maybe the best catcher in the game at the time? And, she was very nice. She, put us in touch. A couple days later, I remember going to your house. We sat Zach in his weight room. And I go with bats and batting gloves and thinking, okay, we're going to grind out hitting. And we talked for about 3 hours about hitting and about baseball and about your body. And I just sat there and went, wow. And I'll never forget when I left your house that day, you said, so that was a Tuesday. And you said, do you want to come back Thursday and hit? And you talk about a happy camper. I was a 20-year-old kid. And I just got invited back to what was going to be a Hall of Fame catcher's house to learn how to hit. I was a hell yes. And we hit together, I don't know, 7 or 8 straight years, a lot in your garage and wherever we could do it. And, you know, I just really appreciated it, still do. And it made a massive impact on my career as a Major League Baseball player.
Well, that's nice to be involved and nice to know that, you know, be so receptive. I think one thing as you know, sort of technology has improved and you know, all the, I guess, the scientific part of the hitting and what happens that, you know, basically it's the same, but it's, you know, it's progressed to the point where there's a little bit of different mental approach, but the basics are still the same. The basics are still the same, and I think that if you get started off right, we can not be quite so rigid and be a little more, you know, a little more compromising in the approach. But it's changed because the strike zone has changed. It's changed because the rules have changed. It used to be, you know, you could pitch inside, you could scare somebody, you could, they find out quick whether you were a man enough to get back in the box after you're sit on your butt a few times. You take a good swing and you better watch out where that next pitch is coming from. So guys don't have to worry about that anymore. So it's a little bit different where they can lean and launch and not be too concerned. That's why some of the offensive numbers are verge on obscene. But back in the day, you wouldn't be leaning over the plate as many times as you do. And they'd find out real quick whether you were a player or not.
Zach, two things about Pudge. One, I got a question for you. But the thing all culminated in 1999, him and I's relationship of friendship and baseball. I was selected to the 99 All-Star Game by Joe Torre to represent the Twins for the American League at Fenway Park. Who do you think was our team captain for the Boston Red Sox for the All-Star Game in 99? Carlton. It was really a great, great moment for me. It had to be great for you being team captain in your old ballpark. But, you know, we had gone back from 20 years old of you working, flipping baseballs at me going, nope, nope. Ah, that one's a little better. Nope, nope. to us playing in an all-star game and you being our team captain in the big leagues. What a change.
Well, I was so proud of you to play the way you did you know, be viewed the way you did. I know Kelly let you play a little bit up there, and Torre recognized that you deserved to be there. And I was selected as the honorary captain for the All-Star team that year, and I was coaching first base. You know, I was just standing there because I don't know what a first base coach does. But but to do that, you know, I was really honored to be the honorary captain. My last All-Star game was in Toronto, and guess who were the co-honorary captains for the American League? Joe DiMaggio and Ted Williams. And they came into our dugout, and everybody almost got on their knees and said, oh, you know, we're bowing to them because they've made such a presence in the – they didn't get dressed, they didn't get a uniform on, but they came into the dugout. Of course, Ted Williams just had his open neck golf shirt on, and Joe DiMaggio had on a 3-piece suit and came into the clubhouse, and you go, now that's big leaguer right there. Those guys are Hall of Famers. And now that I had a chance to be an honorary captain, I thought of them and how proud I was to be there. And then of course Toombs was there. So it made everything great.
Yeah, it all came together. Carlton Fisk is our guest here on Chicago Sports Radio 670 The Score. You mentioned some of the changes that have taken place in Major League Baseball from when you played. If baseball came to you and said, we need help, we'd like to make the game a little bit better, what would your advice be, and how could they go about doing that?
That's a good question. You know, I always say that I was pretty glad that I played baseball when baseball was baseball. It's changed in a lot of different ways. The way they, you know, the shift, for one thing, they started employing that on me, you know, my last couple of years that I played. the way they change, the way they view their pitching staff and the way they set up their pitching rotation and their whole roster has changed. And as a result, I think the games are longer and there's less. I don't know if there's less interest, but I know for me viewing it, you kind of lose track of the flow of the game when you have so many changes going on within the game. And now they have the instant replay, and I think that's, you know, it might be a good idea, but it's being used for part of the game that I don't think it should be used for. When the guy slides into second base, and the infielder keeps the tag on, and the runner pops up on the bag, and he, you know, loses contact for the bag for a quarter of an inch for a bazillionth of a second. And they call them out. I don't think it should be used that way. You know, I think it should be used for obvious things. But for that minuscule part of the game, I don't think it should be used for that. But I think, you know, it's a much softer game. And I think if you wanted to get players really involved, I think you'd have to stiffen it up a little bit.
So with that being said, Pudge, I got a question for you.
Uh-oh.
There was a video. Yeah, buddy. I've addressed this on the Aaron Cubs radio many times. I'm very open about how I feel of what's going on now. But the Houston Astros and the sign stealing and all of those things that went on. One of your young White Sox pitchers was, you know, he had that happen to him. And it was on film. And it was part of the case against the Houston Astros. If Carlton Fisk is behind home plate and you caught Tom Seaver, I mean, you caught how many Hall of Famers? One of my favorite people on the planet that I was around as a young player, Louis Tiant. Pick some of these guys. If you're behind home plate and you think someone's banging a garbage can to give your signs to the hitter as the pitch is coming, what would Carlton Fisk and Louis Tiant or Tom Seaver do?
I don't think there's any question what you do, because if you choose to take a good swing, you'd catch one in the neck. I think that that's that particular part of the game. It shouldn't be forgotten. I know if I was a player, I wouldn't forget it. I mean, who was that, Tanaka or somebody? Who's your pitcher there that was pitching really well? And
you, Darvish.
Darvish. That's what Darvish was pitching well and goes down there and gets lit up more than once, and you go, well, wait a minute. I thought I was pitching good. But here's what would happen. Now, Lamar Hoyt's pitching for us, a Cy Young Award winner, right?
Yeah.
There's a guy on the on-deck circle. You know, he's taking his warm-ups between innings, and he's looking at the pitcher, looking at Lamar, and trying to time it. Now, he's on the on-deck circle. The inning hasn't even started, and Lamar whistled one past his head. And Lamar had such great control, he could have hit him in the kneecap if he wanted to, but he just threw it right past the guy and go, time that! And the guy stopped pretty quick. So if that happens on the on-deck circle, guess what would happen if the game starts? And I think that's what would happen. You know, you'd have there'd be some contentions for sure. There'd be a lot of confrontations, but it wouldn't go unnoticed or rewarded, if that's what you want to call it. There'd be some issues.
And don't you think that's better for the game? And I don't mean the fighting part of it. I mean policing yourself and understanding that people aren't going to get an advantage because of technology and cheating our game the way it's supposed to be played on the field. If you find that out, I know from playing third base and Clemens being on the mound, if somebody would have done that to Roger, I know he would have hit him in the neck. No doubt about it. I wouldn't even have had to put a glove on at third base because they wouldn't have needed
to hit. That's exactly the right, you know, because I know I experienced that with Roger myself. Hit a couple home runs off him, and guess what? You're on your back, and he's saying, oh, yeah, I'll try to hit that one out of the ballpark. But here's a little story right here. Roger Clemens on the mound, and there's a man on second base, and he's trying to give away location inside, outside, you know, and usually if it's inside, it's a fastball, and outside, it could be a breaking ball.
Right.
And Roger catches on to that whole thing. You know, I'm not going to use all the expletives, but he turned around to the guy at second base and said, if you do that again, the next time you come up, you're going to catch one in the ribs, and this guy at the plate isn't going to stand a chance. And the worst part about Roger, you know, he's 6'6 and weighs 260. He'd drill you in the back, and you want to go out there, guess what? He'd crush you with a fastball, and he'd beat the crap out of you if you ever got out there. So you just have to say, I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. I didn't mean to do that.
But that's when you're standing at home plate, and you point out at your own player at second base and go, don't do that.
Don't do that. I don't care. I don't want to do that.
I'll punch out. It's okay.
I'll just go back to the dugout. I don't want to take a fastball in the net.
Our final few moments here with Baseball Hall of Famer Carlton Fisk. Now, I bring this up, I don't know if you had a chance to watch The Last Dance while you've been in quarantine, but Coom and I have talked a lot about that documentary and Michael Jordan's impact. And, you know, when Michael Jordan joined the Bulls, you were the star on the south side of Chicago. There are very few people in this city that can relate to what he went through and the things he had to overcome. But one of the things that stood out to me, and in thinking about you, I think there's the parallel where Michael talks about his work ethic and how the best player on the team worked the hardest. And there were no days off. There was no load management when it came to Michael Jordan. And you were the same way during your baseball career and doing it catching, which is even more rigorous than the other positions. Did you watch it, and what did you take away from seeing Michael Jordan through the dynasty years?
Well, you know, I lived through the dynasty years, and so I knew, you know, I don't know everything that happened in the back room, but I do know that your best players are your hardest workers. One, they don't accept second best, and they don't accept being lesser than the guy that they're playing against. So you do what you do. And I've always thought that, you know, a stronger, better conditioned athlete, you know, talent aside or talent equal, is obviously a better player, a better athlete. And you just don't ever forget that, and you don't ever want to lose that edge. So you do whatever it takes. I always figured that you know, commitment has no off season. If you're committed to being the best or one of the best or trying to be your best, then there is no off season. You're continually working. You're continually striving to get better. And as a result, you stay at that level longer. I know that I did. I know the last year and a half, it wasn't very good, but I mean, I was still in uniform when I was 45 years old. So I know that it pays off to you know, basically not listen to your body, although I have to listen to it now, but I didn't then.
But your workouts were legendary at the ballpark, at Comiskey, and they just were. Everybody knew it. Phil Clawson, who was a very good friend of yours and your trainer. I mean, all of your workouts. Here, I'll read you a quote from one of your old managers. Pudge works harder than anyone I know because he sets goals for himself and then follows through. I think he's the ultimate professional. Former White Sox manager Jim Fergusi. That just kind of talks exactly about what you're talking about with Jordan and what he thought about you.
Well, I think that's like I say, yeah, I think if you want to be the best, you have to work harder than anybody else. You have to be involved. You have to be more enthusiastic. You just don't take no for an answer. You know, if you fail in one particular area, then you have to find out why and then remedy that. So throughout the years, I think the best players do that. You know, you have to have some talent, obviously, to stay on top, but in order to stay there and maintain that distance, I guess you call it distance between, you know, the elite player and the player, then that's what you have to do.
And at the end of the day, all of us at some point have been told you're not good enough, you're not going to make it, you're not, whatever that is, even if you're a star player. Not accepting the word no and not putting that in your vocabulary, that's what separates guys getting to the big leagues, and that's, to your point, what separates the guys that are good big league players from the elite.
Well, you got to think, too, you know, I came from New Hampshire. My high school baseball season was 12 games. And really, I did not play. I played about 100 games as an amateur and before I signed and went to Waterloo, Iowa. But there's guys that played in California that played 200-plus games a year. Fred Lynn said he played 220 games one year, you know, playing for USC in spring, fall, summer. He played 200 days a year. So it's I had a lot of, you know, a lot of catching up to do, a lot of, you know, failures, a lot of having to recognize what it's going to take. And there's a lot of guys that, you know, you see him in batting practice or you see him in the bullpen and you go, wow, this guy can really do it. But in order to step up there and be by yourself at the plate and by yourself on the mound, there's only one person that's accountable, and that's you. And you have to be. You have to be accountable. And if you're not, then you're just, that might be the last time you play, because you're not going to be successful every time you throw a ball. You're not going to be successful every time you swing the bat. And there's a reason. And you've got to find that out, and you've got to be able to, you've got to be able to think and get to the next level. So it's more than just running to first base or throwing a ball.
Yeah, there's no substitute for hard work. Final question before we say goodbye here, because we're short on time. I know there are a lot of White Sox fans listening. How close have you kept up to date with the moves that they've made throughout the offseason and gearing up for the 2020 season on the South Side?
Well, I think it's definitely a positive move, and I'm not sure what took them so long from 05, but they made a nice move behind the plate, and they made some nice moves elsewhere. So I think that they've come to the recognition that in order to be more than just competitive, you have to have a few elite players, and they have to influence the other players on the team. And as a result, I know there's a lot of optimism on the South Side. So I'm pretty excited to see what's going to happen.
Any final thoughts for Coombe?
Well, no.
How many strokes do I get tomorrow if we play?
I was the other way around.
What are you playing your course? Hold on, pal.
Yeah. I just want to say hi to Connor and Sean. I know the big Cubs fans and a Ron Coomer fan. So remember what he said, Connor. Remember, anytime.
Connor, we will have Connor and Sean. We will
anytime,
have you.
Anytime, Sean.
Anytime. That's right. And you get Grandpa to put that Cubs hat on, and we'll do all kinds of special things for you guys.
Boy, that's it. You get that close up. Make sure that camera's on me, because it might not last too long.
I bet not.
Great stuff. Hey, Carlton Fisk, thank you so much for sharing some great stories and memories with us.
Well, thank you for having me, and I hope baseball gets started. Good luck to South Side. Good luck to the North Side, and Coombe, say hi to Pat. I always liked him.
Will do, buddy. Thanks for coming on with us. We really appreciate it. It's always great
All
to
right.
talk to you.
Yep, anytime, anytime.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend, or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.